Welcome to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a weekly roundtable discussion of events and issues facing the church and culture today. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Diocese of Colorado Springs and the Catholic Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Hello, this is Bishop Michael Sheridan. I'm happy to welcome you to this roundtable discussion about one of the most important topics of our time, and that is health care reform. And joining me for the discussion are Jennifer Kraska, who is the executive director of the Colorado Catholic Conference. Jenny keeps us Colorado bishops well informed on what's going on in both the local and the national level. So welcome, Jenny. And also joining us is Dr. Peter Zimmer, a surgeon at St. Francis Hospital here in Colorado Springs. Maybe before we begin our discussion, Jenny, why don't you just say a few things about yourself and who you are and what you do.
Sure. As Bishop Sheridan mentioned, I am the executive director of the Catholic Conference. And for those of you that don't know, the Catholic Conference is the public policy and lobbying arm for the three Catholic dioceses in Colorado. I come to Colorado via Minnesota, where I was and am a lawyer by trade.
Very good. Thank you. Peter?
Thank you for having me here, Bishop. I'm a general surgeon. I work primarily out of St. Francis Medical Center and Memorial North in northern Colorado Springs, and I'm a parishioner of St. Francis of Assisi here in the diocese on the north end of Colorado Springs.
Great, and you will have, of course, your own particular perspective, I'm sure, on this whole.
Absolutely, maybe I can provide some insight from the trenches, so to speak, colored perhaps by my own views. But thank you for having me here.
Very good, very good. Maybe before we begin to navigate this minefield, it seems like we're really dealing with a kind of a moving target. We're not sure what's out there from day to day. But a good place to start our discussion, I think, would be to remind everyone that the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, through its Committee on Domestic Justice and Human Development, has written a letter to all of the senators and United States representatives. It was Bishop William Murphy, who's the chairman of this committee, that wrote on behalf of the bishops to the senators and to the representatives, offering our particular perspective on healthcare reform, kind of articulating general moral, ethical principles. And just to begin our discussion, or to set a context for it, let me read what Bishop Murphy wrote to the Senate, to the Congress, back in July. He says that as Congress begins debate on health care reform, the Catholic bishops of the United States offer the following criteria for fair and just health care reform. Health care reform needs to reflect basic ethical principles. And so the bishop offers these four as a guide. First, that it is a truly universal health policy with respect for human life and dignity. Second, that there is access for all, with a special concern for the poor and inclusion of legal immigrants. Now, since that letter was written, I think there's been a plea now that all immigrants, documented or otherwise, be included in this. The third ethical principle, pursuing the common good and preserving pluralism, including freedom of conscience, that's an important thing, and variety of options. And finally, restraining costs and applying them equitably across the spectrum of payers. So that's sort of the general ethical and moral framework that the bishops are asking our legislators to work out of. Jenny, I'm going to turn to you and let you. You have the task of kind of filling us in as well as you can on a very complicated and difficult but important issue. Where are we?
That's a good question, and I think you described it very well, Bishop, when you said it was a moving target, so to speak. The major misconceptions that we're operating under is that there is one bill out there that everyone is talking about and everyone is referring to when we hear about healthcare reform. At this point, that's false. There's not one bill that all the senators and all the representatives are going to be dealing with. Right now, we can point to sort of two major pieces of legislation, just in general. And the first is what we heard most commonly talked about over the course of the summer and into September, which is came out of the House committees that it went through. It had to go through three House committees. So there's basically three different versions of what's referred to as HR 3200. And that's sort of what you will hear referred to the most.
There are three versions just of 3200.
Just of 3200. It had to go through three committees. It got marked up in these committees. It got reviewed in these committees. So there's different versions out there of what is now known as HR 3200. In some form or another, it made it through all of those committees. It has passed through all those committees. There has been different amendments offered at different points in time, some that we have pushed for and not have not gotten onto the bill, others that we have actively opposed. So that's where we are in the House right now with healthcare legislation. That bill is out there. Then we go over to the Senate side of the equation, and there's two committees in the Senate that legislation had to go through. There was one committee on health and education that heard one version of a Senate bill. And now, as of last week, there's a new version, which is being sort of touted as a compromise bill by Senator Baucus out of Montana. And that's the bill right now that is probably garnering the most attention for us in the news media and in print media. What we'll see is what is referred to as the Baucus bill right now. And so that's where we're at, really, from a legislative perspective. As of last week, the Baucus bill had introduced to it 564 amendments.
Oh, my.
So we're really looking at a massive piece of legislation. And I think the important thing to remember when talking about this is that as of right now, we are not talking about just one bill. There's sort of these versions out there that we're going to have to deal with and look at. They still have a lengthy process to go through before we will actually see something that might be presented to the president, for example, for him to sign into law.
So what we're trying to do at this point, as Catholics anyway, is to try to continue to repeat these moral and ethical principles. We don't know where exactly this is going. We don't know what the final version is going to look like, but we want to make sure that whatever direction it goes in, these moral principles are attended to.
Exactly. And we have people working very hard at the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, along with our state delegations, that are working hard with our senators and our congressional representatives to, for example, in this 564 amendments that were offered to the Baucus bill, we, and when I say we, the church, the USCCB, has offered many amendments to that bill that addresses the principles and concerns you set out at the beginning of the show.
All right. Very good. Peter, I'm going to turn to you because a question that I hear asked or I read it being asked, and there's quite a variety of answers to it. Why, if at all, do we need health care reform in this country?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who doesn't believe, including physicians, that we don't need some type of reform. What I think a lot of people, including physicians, have a problem with is that the whole system is fundamentally broken and needs to be fixed or taken over by the government. And it's an emergency that needs to be fixed because I, for one, and most physicians, I think, would agree that our system is fundamentally still the best in the world. If I had a severe illness, I would still want to be in the United States of America, taken care of by my colleagues, with the health system as it currently is. That having said that, there are certainly problems with our healthcare system, including access to care, access, you know, for the poor and indigent and for people with severe medical problems who have difficulty getting insurance, particularly if they're unemployed. And also, obviously, the skyrocketing costs to the system. And I think perhaps we can talk about it later, but I think fear of litigation and the current malpractice system and tort reform is probably the major concern among physicians overall, I would say, across the board. But those, I think, are some of the fundamental problems. especially speaking as a physician, I don't think that it's an emergency. There's it's fundamentally flawed or broken. I think we have a good healthcare system, and rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and start from scratch, we need to take a good system with some flaws and try and fix those flaws.
Do you think the direction we seem to be headed in at this point is an overhaul that's just too massive, too unnecessary, or what?
Generally speaking, yes. I would have to agree. Now, you know, I don't think the insurance companies are perfect by any stretch. I have a lot of issues with many of them. But I am fearful that the government believes that they're going to do things any better than private industry has been able to do. And perhaps that's some of my political views coming out, but I've never seen the government do anything better than the private system, be it Medicare, Social Security, the post office, Amtrak. These are all systems started by the government that are fundamentally bankrupt and cannot compete without our taxpayer support. Number one, problems should be solved on a local level, including taking care of our poor and indigent, fundamentally on a local level, and fundamentally by the private sector.
Okay, you mentioned the local level, and that's really a principle of our Catholic social justice teaching, the principle of subsidiarity. And a lot of people who argue, in a sense, against this top-down, well, not top-down reform, but this running of the healthcare system, if that's what's going to happen by the federal government, is not attending to the doctrine of subsidiarity, meaning that when and where something can be done at a lower level, at a level closer to the people that are being served, it should be done there. Jenny, do you think we're beyond the principle of subsidiarity? Do we have to turn to the federal government, do you think, to do this?
No, I don't think that we need to, in a massive overhauling type of way, turn to the federal government on this issue. I think actually the Catholic Church brings a great witness to this in respect into this principle of subsidiarity, in respect to if we look at how our own charity operations are run in dioceses across the nation in regards to Catholic Charities. We very much understand and try to attune ourselves to the needs of those that are most vulnerable in our local communities, whether that be through individual homeless shelters and soup kitchens and things like that. We deal with things on a very local level as they're happening in our community and in our neighborhoods via our systems like Catholic Charities. And so I actually think that that is a great witness to, or should be a great witness to, those making our laws right now in how we don't need an overhaul, a massive overhaul of our system, where the federal government would take control of all these things. If left up to the local communities, they are the ones that are best able to understand the needs of that community. And really, the needs are going to differ from community to community on these issues of healthcare, especially healthcare. And so who better than a local community to really be able to deal effectively with that issue.
Right. Peter, I'm going to pick up on something that you said earlier, talking about access. And of course, this is one of the principles that Bishop Murphy speaks of, access for all. And maybe you could talk a little bit about it as a professional. Certainly in our at least in our not-for-profit hospitals, which Catholic hospitals belong, we have a great tradition of serving the poor, of giving access to at least fundamental and basic health care. We don't turn anyone away, but it sounds like that's not quite enough.
Well, I agree. And the Catholic hospitals, you know, were initially started, you know more about this than I do, the Sisters of Charity. And in fact, you know, Penrose Hospital here in Colorado Springs was started by...
I think the Catholic Church invented hospitals.
I think they did. And so,
I would agree.
And yeah, so that's been a fundamental part of the history of the Catholic Church. But when we talk about access to care, I don't think... You kind of have to define it a little bit, because Chuck Morris said in his recent article, you know, virtually everyone in our country, rich and poor, legal or illegal, has access to the finest care available in the world today. Anybody can go to any emergency room with appendicitis, a car accident, trauma, And they're going to get taken care of, period, regardless of ability to pay. Mm-hmm. So everyone in this country already has access. The question is, who's going to pay for it? And I think that's where it gets a little sticky. Right. And that's when it comes to cost and who's going to pay for all these things. Because no one in America dies of appendicitis because they couldn't find a doctor to take care of them. Right. And we do plenty of pro bono care. We take care of all comers who come to the emergency room. And that's federal law. And so access to care isn't necessarily a problem. What is a problem is, say you're a middle-aged diabetic with high blood pressure and you got laid off, and now you don't have insurance through your employer, and now you can't go find out an insurance company whose job it is to make money, let's face it, is going to be willing to take on the risk and insure that person. So people fall through the cracks with severe medical problems, and many people just frankly choose not to carry medical insurance. And so then the problem comes up with, you know, so-called access to care because they don't have a doctor. They can't find a physician who will take their insurance or their Medicare, what the case may be. So when you talk about access to care, when there's a severe problem and you need to go to the emergency room, you're going to get taken care of in this country regardless. But I think the sticky point that comes up is cost. Who's going to pay for it?
Dr. Zimmer referred to Chuck Marr's article on healthcare reform, and that article appears in the September 4th, 2009 edition of the Colorado Catholic Herald. It's entitled A Radical Observation, so you can certainly go to that article to get Chuck's take on this. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back with Jenny Kraska, who is the executive director of the Colorado Catholic Conference, and with Dr. Peter Zimmer, a surgeon at St. Francis Medical Center here in Colorado Springs. And we are discussing healthcare reform as that is progressing in our country. And Peter, you said indeed, who's going to pay for this healthcare? Jenny, you wanted to address that question?
Yeah, I actually have a question for Dr. Zimmer. My understanding is that right now, when people go, anybody can go to the emergency room and get care, but right now that is one of the most, if not the most expensive modes of care that people can receive. And so do you think that is being adequately addressed or will be addressed with healthcare reform? Or how would you address that, I guess?
No, that's a very good point, and actually you're absolutely correct. And unfortunately, the emergency room becomes the de facto place of care for many people without health insurance because, you know, we were talking about access to care. If you don't have insurance, you're going to have a hard time finding a doctor who's going to be willing to take care of you unless you're going to pay cash out of pocket. And so the emergency room becomes de facto the place to go for colds and flu symptoms, or, you know, whatever the case may be, rather than a family physician or a primary care physician, pediatrician that you should probably be seeing in the first place. So, and that comes up against the problem again of, you know, not having health insurance in our country. And depending on who you talk to, between 30, 40, or 50 million Americans do not have health insurance and thus do not receive regular medical care or have a physician they can call when they have a problem. And so that does become, you know, an access problem, so to speak. Absolutely.
Do you see the current or anything that you know of any current proposals addressing that concern? Because I guess one of the things that I've heard in sort of the debate about emergency room use is that even if we do make access to health insurance easier for people, there's still going to be a large group of people, especially those that maybe are not here in a documented fashion in the United States, and they will still continue because they won't be able to receive insurance. They will still be primarily for healthcare purposes using emergency rooms. So is there any way that we're really going to effectively deal with those costs associated with that, or are we still going to see the increasing costs in the emergency room?
Very good question, and I'm not sure I have all the answers. I don't think there's a quick fix for that because even among the 40 million or so Americans in the country right now with health insurance, many of those people could choose to have health insurance if they desired it, but they just choose not to pay for it. I see young, healthy, you know, teenagers, people in their 20s and 30s who are healthy but choose not to have health insurance, and granted, it is expensive, but it's also very expensive to get sick and have an appendectomy or you know, tonsillectomy that you're not planning on, or another operation or severe medical problem. I don't think necessarily even having insurance available is necessarily going to solve the problems, because there are still going to be many people who choose not to carry that insurance. It comes up with the whole question about, you know, is health care a basic human right? Are we so-called entitled to health care? And I think most people in the country at this point would say yes, and that's a sticky question. I think it's a good question for my shepherd on the right here, the bishop. Is health care a basic human right? I think we all have the right to be taken care of when we're sick, but the question, you know, if you have a hernia that's not an emergency, do you have a right? Are you entitled that somebody should take care of that for you and you should not have to pay? I don't necessarily agree, and there are some problems where obviously it is necessary and somewhere maybe it's not so. But that's, you know, bottom line is health care costs money. Whether you pay for it every month like I do with health insurance, whether you choose not to pay and then pay as your problems come up, but health care costs money. And the question is, who's going to pay for it?
And, you know, to address your question at least briefly, Peter, I'm not so sure in our Catholic social justice doctrine or moral doctrine that we would put access to health care quite in the same category as we do our unalienable rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Certainly we do have a fundamental human right to food and to water, to literally keep us alive. But I think access to adequate health care goes along with that. It may fall into a different category. I think it was, I read recently, it was Archbishop Chaput who phrased it this way. It's an obligation of a just society. Whether you could argue it's a fundamental human right, or it's the obligation of a just society, it's something that I think as people of faith and people of goodwill, we can't set aside, as I've heard some people try to do, that, you know, this is not an entitlement, and it's up to you to figure out how you're going to get your health care. I don't think we're going to take quite that position.
The more I think about it, the fundamental question isn't access, it's cost. Because it doesn't matter if you don't have a health insurance. You know, if you have money, you are going to, and you're willing to pay for your health care, even out of pocket, and I have patients who choose to do that because they are either very wealthy and just choose not to have health insurance, or they just choose to pay as they go. Access is not a problem. If you have money, you're going to find people right, willing to take care of you. So access isn't really the problem. It's who's going to pay for it. And, you know, is it a fundamental right? Are you entitled to health care? And again, referring back to Chuck Marr's article, health care is interesting because when it comes to health care, we're often passive bystanders in terms of receiving that care. You know, if we had so-called grocery insurance and we got to go to the grocery store and somebody paid for our groceries, and so we just choose what we wanted to buy, of course we'd buy the best meats and the organic vegetables and the most expensive cereal without any reference to what the cost was, because we wouldn't be paying for it. A third party would be paying for it. But when it comes to health care, nobody goes to their doctor and says, well, how much is this MRI going to cost? How much is this CT scan going to cost? They just want the CT, they want the MRI, they want the best antibiotic, because it should be coming to them. They're entitled to that, or they have their insurance paying for it. And so if people had more of a personal responsibility for their own health and their own health care payments, it might change the argument substantially. But health care is one area where we have become passive consumers. We don't care what it costs.
You know, this is really an important area we're in, but I'd like to just change the direction of the discussion for a moment here. There's an awful lot of concern out there among many people as to what may or may not be included in whatever turns out to be the final health care reform legislation in this country. We hear the concern, will this pay for abortions? Will it subsidize embryonic stem cell research? Will there be some sort of encouragement to euthanasia, to end one's life early because of these costs, et cetera? I mean, I know we're not there yet, Jenny, but what's your take on these kinds of things, which are of grave concern to Catholics and to many others?
Absolutely. And I think that the bishops have in this area spoken very specifically about issues that Catholics should be concerned about in regards to health care, and whether or not these provisions end up in a final version of any health care legislation is yet to be determined. But I think some of the big areas that we're seeing major concerns with right now, and where I think most of the misconceptions lie, are in a few very fundamental areas. And let me start with one being abortion. It is probably the biggest area and should be the biggest concern to Catholics, is whether there will be an expansion of what is funded, federally funded, the federal funding of abortion services, et cetera. Right now, currently, the state of affairs operates under what is called the Hyde Amendment. And the Hyde Amendment says that federal funds cannot be used except in very certain circumstances, rape, incest, right, things like that, to fund abortions. The concern with the healthcare legislation is that the Hyde Amendment will not cover those aspects of the bill that are going to be funded in healthcare legislation. And let me explain, if I can, in a simple way, how that works. Right now, as I mentioned, the Hyde Amendment covers the area of the federal funding of abortion and does not allow it. The reason that the Hyde Amendment is successful and is used is because it applies to any funding that comes out of the Health and Human Services Appropriations Budget. Why that is so important and why it's causing, I think, a lot of confusion and concern for people is that the current drafts of legislation that we have in the healthcare debate would not be funded primarily through the Health and Human Services Appropriations Bill. Therefore, the Hyde Amendment would not apply to that. So
we get around the Hyde Amendment that way?
Right. We get around the Hyde Amendment, or the proponents of this bill are getting around the Hyde Amendment because the funding for this bill will not primarily come through the Health and Human Services Appropriation Bills. And this is really the major concern that the bishops have right now, is how are we going to deal with that? Because what that will mean is a vast expansion of abortion coverage by the federal government, our tax dollars being used to pay for and fund abortions. That's probably one of the things that we're working the hardest on at the federal level with our congressional representatives and senators to deal with. We've offered amendments to just simply say the Hyde Amendment will be extended to apply to the bill in its entirety, regardless of funding. Those amendments have been denied and knocked down.
We'll continue this discussion after a quick break. All right, we are back once again with Jenny Kraska, Executive Director of the Colorado Catholic Conference, and Dr. Peter Zimmer, surgeon at St. Francis Medical Center in Colorado Springs. And Jenny and Peter, feel free also to jump in on this. I know as a Catholic physician, you would have your own serious concerns about abortion being funded in any kind of healthcare reform. Let me ask you this. Did we not hear from no less than our president himself that abortions would not be paid for by this health care reform?
Yes, we've heard on at least a couple of occasions very publicly where President Obama has spoken specifically to the issue of abortion coverage and conscience protection rights. Specifically, if you read his speech that he gave at the Notre Dame commencement, yeah, he specifically talks about the fact that nothing will change in regards to what is currently status quo regarding the federal funding of abortion. And he also talked about the need for conscience protection rights in any kind of healthcare reform legislation. He also echoed the same concerns in his September 9th address to Congress, where he brought up again both of these issues. He promised the nation, really, that these things regarding abortion would not change and that there would be conscience protection rights.
There are those, though, who say we should not bank on that. I don't mean any disrespect, but
no, and no disrespect should at all be thought because we're bringing this up. But the fact of the matter is, President Obama has not offered any concrete evidence that he's willing to back up what he is saying. There have not been amendments offered by him or his staff or senators on his behalf regarding these aspects of healthcare reform. And so until that happens, I think that we do have to be somewhat skeptical.
And we have to be very vigilant.
Absolutely.
I agree. And, you know, as a Catholic and a physician, those are primary concerns to me, particularly, the funding of abortion and so forth. Knowing his history with NARAL and his very pro-abortion stance, I'm skeptical that there won't be any inclusion. So I agree with the bishop. I think we have to be vigilant. I think we can be hopeful that he's telling the truth and that he will back that up. But unfortunately, he has a very pro-abortion Congress and House in particular that I think may send him a bill. And I do not think he will veto the bill if that's the only thing he finds wrong with it. So I think we have to be vigilant. That's obviously a primary concern. And the other thing that the bishop brought up was the conscience clause, which our previous president was a big proponent of, that basically says that physicians do not have to perform procedures or prescribe medication that is against their conscience, which I think is a fundamental human liberty and human right that any physician should have. And in particular, when it comes specifically, I think we're talking about performing abortions and also performing contraceptive procedures or prescribing contraceptives. There's major concern among not all physicians, obviously, but among those of us who are in line with Catholic teaching about abortion and contraception, that we would be forced to, if I was a gynecologist, that I would be forced to perform abortions, or if I was a family physician, that I would be forced to provide contraception if it was against my conscience, which is fundamentally, I think, an imposition upon my liberty as a physician or a pharmacist to heed my own conscience. That's a major concern. And President Obama has, said in the past that he favors eliminating that conscience clause. And one problem the abortion industry have, fortunately, if you'll talk to Father Pavone from Priests for Life, is that there are fewer and fewer and fewer physicians willing to perform abortion. And I think this is an end around. But I think when it comes to an issue as fundamental as abortion, on which people are, and especially people like myself that are pro-life and believe life begins at conception, there's nothing that a federal law is going to do that's going to change or force me, or it's not in my realm of practice, but any gynecologist to perform abortion. I think you're going to see a lot of civil disobedience, frankly, if that happens. But obviously, the conscience clause and any provisions for pro-life or rationing care at the end of life are of major concerns. And I agree with the bishop, we need to be vigilant about that in any bill.
And just following up on that vigilance piece, I think it is very important. And one of the aspects that we don't hear talked about a lot in being vigilant is looking at how the other side or maybe people who would have a different view than us are viewing this issue. And namely, in this regard, on these issues is Planned Parenthood and NARAL. As you'll notice, if you read anything that's been put out recently by them, they are not coming out saying that, in fact, this keeps the status quo of abortion funding. They're in support of the current plans that are being put out. And I think that should tell us something.
Yes.
As Catholics of where this healthcare plan is headed if there's not serious amendments and serious inroads made to change those views.
One of the things that, again, many people are concerned about, and Peter, you may want to speak to this, is what's come to be known as healthcare rationing. Should there be a certain kind of healthcare reform in order to save money, to not have the massive expenses for healthcare that we have now? There's going to be some, of necessity, some form of rationing. What's your understanding and take on that?
Well,
as a doctor,
that's a very difficult situation as well. Does a 98-year-old patient with multiple medical problems, whose life expectancy is 1 year, should they undergo chemotherapy for a cancer that might prolong their life 6 months or 12 months? That's where
But I mean, there the church would be kind of clear, I think, on what would be morally required there, and it would not be that a patient would have to, I think, undergo chemotherapy simply to prolong one's
life. And so when you're talking about rationing of care, I think what we're talking about, you know, if you're 80 years old and you fall and need to have a hip replacement, just because you're 80, does that mean, oh, we're not going to pay for that? And I think, you know, the so-called death panels that got a lot of publicity with HR 3200, elderly patients having, not so elderly even, having to meet with a so-called, you know, social worker every 5 years to discuss their end of life. I think there's a lot of fear, and justly so, because given the amount of money available and what they say this is going to cost, there's going to have to be some sort of rationing of care with these provisions. Scary for me to hear President Obama talk at one of these town hall meetings he was at when a woman said, well, my mother just had surgery. She's 100 years old and she did great. Are you telling me that if that happened under the future plan? And he suggested that she just, her mother maybe would have been better off with pain pills. These things are kind of scary to me. And the other comments that he's made about us physicians doing surgery just to make money, that we don't have the best interests of our patients at hand. But, you know, rationing of care is a tricky subject because we often provide extraordinary care, I think, at the end of life that may or may not be necessary. But fundamentally, I think if you're making, you know, age is not a number. And when we say that just because you're such and such age, you're not eligible for such and such care, or there's going to be rationing, that's very scary to me.
And I think one of the, going back to sort of some of the misconceptions that we were talking about, and Dr. Zimmer brought this up, is in regards to death panels in that term. I think it's, for our listeners, we should point out that the term death panel was not in the legislation.
Right.
The term the term euthanasia, the term physician-assisted suicide.
Abortion isn't even in there,
An
is
abortion
it?
Was not even in, in the language. And so when we're talking about this, we are reading the bills, the thousands of pages of them, and determining what they could have the potential of doing.
Because the language is often very vague.
Exactly.
And it could be interpreted, right?
Absolutely. And that's the end of life counseling. What does that mean? Who's going to decide what end of life counseling means? What could it potentially lead to? And those are the where the concerns arose in terms of what has been referred to as death panels.
But correct me if I'm wrong, that in the bill there also was going to be a presidential appointed panel that was going to be making many of these decisions. And back what we said earlier about
subsidiarity.
Subsidiarity, that a group of five men centrally in Washington making these decisions for hundreds of millions of Americans, that goes completely against that principle, and decisions need to be made on a patient-by-patient basis between a patient and their physician. I think the relationship between a patient and the physician, the autonomy for deciding care, is at risk when we start talking about panels, whatever you want to speak of, and the so-called rationing of care.
Right. And that's one of the areas where, again, goes back to this issue of vigilance and really on trying to understand to the best of our abilities what actually these bills are saying and what they would do. There were many instances in especially H.R. 3200 that commissions, panels were set up. And these what we have to understand and why this should concern us is that these panels and commissions, as Dr. Zimmer pointed out, are people who are appointed by the president and his administration, which means that they have no accountability because they're not elected officials to all of us who they're going to be making decisions for. And I really think that that is an important piece that's not really focused on when we've been talking about healthcare is exactly a big part of any piece of legislation, especially something this big, is the rules and regulations that are made to enforce the legislation. So after, if anything is passed, signed into law, there will be a huge process involving rules and regulations that are made to interpret what was said in these thousand pages or
exactly
whatever it
might enforcing be. The bill comes down to the nuts and bolts. And when you come back to abortion, for example, if there's nothing in there that says you're not going to pay for abortion, it depends on who's in the executive branch of government at that particular time who's going to enforce the law to decide whether or not money's going to pay for abortion, as an example.
Exactly.
We've talked a bit about things that are of concern, things that we certainly don't want to see in any healthcare legislation that might be coming down the line. So I don't know if this is putting you on the spot. We're going to take a little break and maybe you can think about it. But I'm just wondering if the two of you could address what kinds of things would you like to see if you were the ones writing new healthcare legislation. I guess I'm asking you to do what the United States Senate and Congress can't do, is to give us some sense of the direction you'd like to see this whole process go in. We know what we want to leave out. What do we want to look at and hope and if necessary, lobby our congressmen, our senators for in terms of good healthcare legislation that it does attend to those principles that we enunciated at the beginning. So we could think about that for a minute and maybe conclude our discussion when we come back. So we'll just take this quick break.
Well, I can answer that.
Oh, okay, great. Good. Welcome back once again to our discussion on healthcare reform in the United States, healthcare legislation, with Jenny Kraska, the executive director of the Colorado Catholic Conference, and Dr. Peter Zimmer from St. Francis Medical Center in Colorado Springs. And before the break, I asked our two guests to give some thought to the kinds of things, the elements, the principles that they'd like to see ideally in real healthcare reform. We've spoken a bit about the things that we don't want to see in there. So which of you would like to pick that one up first?
I'll defer to the doctor.
All right.
Well, I think one thing, if you talk to physicians, that we primarily would like to see is some sort of tort reform. And that, I think, contributes a lot to the cost, as Chuck Maher mentioned in his column, and many people have mentioned across the country as well. The AMA is brought up and other medical societies. But fundamentally right now, there is so much fear in the medical community about, you know, missing diagnoses and so forth, that there's a lot of so-called defensive medicine that's practiced, and extra so-called unnecessary tests and CTs and MRIs and a whole bunch of things that are done out of the fear of, you know, if you miss something, you're going to turn around and get sued. And
Dr. Zimmer, I don't mean to interrupt, but could you explain, I guess, a little, and you kind of are, but what you mean by tort reform? When you say tort reform, what is that?
Good question. I'm speaking to an attorney, of course. So
I should be the one to ask you, what is tort reform?
Well, the current malpractice system as it exists, and there are injuries that occur to patients, you know, that I believe should be compensated for. But right now, in order to get that compensation, if there's a problem in surgery and there's an unexpected injury, basically the patient has to decide to bring litigation or sue their doctor and begin this extremely antagonistic, hurtful relationship between the patient and the physician involving a third party, an attorney, for substantial amounts of money that involves substantial amounts of time. And if in the end, after all this, and you know, physicians end up retiring because of bad experiences with this and so forth, because fundamental to our being is we want to help people, and when we're accused of something else, that it can be devastating for physicians. Like I said, it also contributes to excess costs with so-called defensive medicine. But if and in the end there is a judgment, and most trials in for the physician, but if there is a judgment, then the patient ends up getting some money, but this is years later, and then the attorney will take a substantial portion of that. I think if we could reform this system somehow, so if there's an injury, that yes, there was an injury, I'm sorry this happened, and there's a list based up on the fact that this happened to you, you're entitled to, you know, this certain amount of money. The patients get get their money much quicker. They remain on good terms with their physician who helped them through this difficult process. And we can also cut down substantially on the cost of medicine. So,
because isn't it true right now that there aren't really a lot of caps on the amount of money that can be awarded to somebody who
Well, fortunately, Colorado is one of the best states in the country right now. There are caps for, you know, so-called pain and suffering in Colorado. I can't quote you the exact. It's like $250,000 or $300,000. So, but many states do not have that and face severe crises in terms of physician shortages, people willing to practice willing to practice medicine in that environment. So, but I think if you talk across the country, tort reform is probably one of the primary concerns that people would like to see, and it also affects the cost of care. President Obama wants us to quit ordering unnecessary tests and doing unnecessary biopsies and unnecessary surgeries. Well, unless this whole system is reformed, I think that's going to be very difficult to do. A second area I think that could be addressed in the new bill is easing restrictions on insurance companies. Right now, there are so many restrictions on what needs to be included in an insurance policy that if a healthy 20-year-old male, for example, wants to go out and buy a catastrophic plan that would, and that's my fundamental disposition on insurance, is that it should pay for emergencies. You know, I have a high deductible plan, so if I get sick, I go see my doctor, I pay him. If I need to get an x-ray, I pay it. Now, once I reach a certain cap, but I want insurance the same way I want it for my house. I don't want my homeowner's insurance to pay for broken light bulbs and swinging doors. I want them to pay me if the house burns down.
Right.
And if I total my car and hurt myself, I want my auto insurance to pay for that. Not if I crack my windshield or if my oil filter needs to be replaced. In the same method, I want my health insurance to pay for me if I get cancer, if I'm in a car accident, if I have appendicitis. And right now, there are no plans available like that because there are so many restrictions that companies have to pay for this and this and this and this and this, that there are few choices available. So, you know, a healthy 20-year-old guy goes to his insurance company, finds out it's going to cost X and X for this exorbitant policy. Well, maybe he doesn't want that. He's healthy. He just wants some bare bones coverage. And Chuck Maher mentioned it in his article as well, but I think if we could ease the restrictions and make so-called catastrophic plans available and affordable, that perhaps some of these 50 million uninsured Americans, many whom could afford and buy their own insurance, might actually do it. And certainly the other problems with access to care, especially for the poor and so forth, but I think trying to completely revamp an already fairly good system that we have is asking for trouble. And some, you know, there's a good old adage that I think applies. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, because you'll end up with unforeseen consequences and further problems than you may not have anticipated in the first place. So that's my 5-minute take on your question about what would I do to fix the current system.
And Jenny, before we give you the floor, let me just pick up on something that Peter said. Well, with regard to tort reform, not being an attorney, I think I know basically what you're talking about. What you say makes sense, but there's great resistance. Why isn't this being taken seriously, or either of you, if you have a?
Well, the other group on the other side of the equation is the trial lawyers.
All right, well,
who have
that's
their
where
own?
I thought we were going.
Frankly, have their own industry, mm-hmm. and frankly.
Stand to lose a great deal of
who
money.
Who are the congressmen and the senators in this country? You know, probably 80%+ yep. of them are lawyers, and they have a vested interest in their own industry, frankly. And the other reason, you know, we haven't heard a whole lot from physicians in this whole debate. Our societies are very involved, and physicians on a certain level are involved. But frankly, we're just trying to do our job and get through the day. We're very busy. We're trying to take care of our patients and wade through all the restrictions and the paperwork as best we can. So, but the attorneys are very much involved and frankly are involved in all levels of government to a high degree. I mean, lawmakers, for the most part, come from that profession.
All right. Well said. We're going to get back to you, Peter, and let you sort of talk for the doctors, if you will, a little bit more. But
I'll do
Jenny,
my best.
What is your plan for?
You know, I would echo some of Dr. Zimmer's concerns. I think for me, two of the major issues are really access and affordability. Affordability in the sense of, and I think Dr. Zimmer captured some ways that we could really make the system more affordable and make it more easily accessible. affordability, just in the sense of, I think people need to see plans that are tailored to them, that they can afford and that they would actually buy and use. And so that means a lot of what has already been discussed, that people need to take a more active role in the healthcare that they're receiving and that they're purchasing, and you know, all those types of things. And I also think that one of the areas that we haven't really touched on is sort of the access to people that have pre-existing medical conditions, and how hard it is really for them to get insurance once they have those, in large part through no fault of their own. These conditions arise. It therefore then becomes extremely difficult if they ever, for example, if somebody with a condition has insurance through their job and they lose that job, to then go and get more insurance somewhere is extremely difficult, if not impossible. And I think that that is a huge area that could use major improvement, and that I would like to see improvement on.
Very good. Peter, you've spoken well and articulately from the point of view of a Catholic doctor. What are the concerns? Have we heard sufficiently from doctors out there in this whole thing, their concerns, their desires for all of this? Is there anything more you'd like to add to that?
Can I add too on to Bishop Sheridan's question while you're answering questions? I've heard, and I don't know if this is just anecdotally, but there's been physicians around the country and in some areas, large amounts of physicians that have said that if the current form of healthcare were to pass in its current form and be signed by the president and be enacted into law, they would just stop practicing medicine. Is there any truth to that, or is that just sort of rhetoric that's out there?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Physicians are concerned about our own welfare and our own well-being, frankly. And how are we going to get paid with this new system? Are we going to take a major pay cut? Is it going to be worthwhile for us to keep operating under this current system? And basically, you know, we're concerned about a wholesale step by step. You know, you open the door and let a little light in, and pretty soon the door is open, the so-called slippery slope. We're concerned about, you know, a wholesale government takeover of healthcare and what that's going to mean to us, and, you know, how we are going to support our families. We're well compensated. We're well paid. And frankly, I don't apologize for that. I spent, you know, I didn't really get a paycheck to speak of till I was 32 years old. I spent my entire 20s in hospitals working for next to nothing, learning my profession. And if we're going to continue to still attract the best and the brightest, so to speak, we need to still compensate our physicians for what they do. And so there's a lot of concern, especially when a lot of physicians, you know, finish medical school with significant amounts of debt. Are we still going to be able to viably keep our practices open and practice with all the increasing restrictions and decreased compensation that a lot of this brings? Yeah, there's a lot. I think that if, for example, HR 3200 passes, you know, if I was a physician who was, you know, nearing retirement and I was faced with this new gauntlet and decreased compensation, I'm and a lot of my colleagues, frankly, would probably just say, you know, this isn't worth it. I enjoy doing what I do, but it frankly is not worth it at this point for me. And I think you would find substantial numbers of physicians who are maybe nearing retirement or don't enjoy their job, and physicians end up doing other things anyhow, leaving their profession or closing their doors to, you know, government programs, etc. Access to care, I think, would only become more of a concern under these circumstances, because if, you know, it's supply and demand, and if there are not physicians willing to work under this system, you're going to have a hard time finding someone to take care of you. You're going to have to wait longer, and I think the systems in the United Kingdom and Canada and so forth have proven that. And so, yeah, I think that's a significant concern, because physicians are frankly getting fed up with a lot of this. And if some substantial bill passed, for example, HR 3200, you would see a significant dropout of physicians willing to practice in this environment, and consequently difficulty with access to care. So, you know, my concern is, as I get older, I'm wondering who's going to take care of me, frankly, when, you know, when I'm old and sick, and, you know, are we still going to have the best healthcare system in the country?
Well, when you say that, it's very, very possible that there'll be fewer
And by the way, hopefully when I'm old, yeah. I'll be sick, not younger. But
I hope so. I hope not, actually. There'll be fewer physicians, but will those open slots then, what, be filled by people of lesser ability as physicians?
Well, perhaps they'll be lesser trained. I don't know. You might find more, you know, mid-level practitioners. You might be not attracting the so-called best and brightest to the profession anymore. Historically, in our country, the doctor-patient relationship and the ability of a doctor and a patient together to decide a proper course of care has been fundamental to our healthcare system. The profession has always been very respected. It's been fairly autonomous in terms of being able to decide what you want to do for your patient. But with all the incredible restrictions and government requirements and decreasing compensation, I'm frankly, you know, a little bit worried about my profession and if it will be still, like I said, attracting the best and the brightest. That's not a concern of mine as a Catholic, but as a physician, as a person, you know, who's going to be willing to take care of me? So those are concerns. You know, right now, the current legislation, as it's been built in every year starting 5 years ago, we as physicians were supposed to face a 3-5% cut in Medicare compensation. Every year, Congress has been putting a Band-Aid on that at the end of every year, to the point where now, if Congress doesn't act next year, all physicians will take a 25-30% cut in Medicare reimbursement. And all our insurance plans are tied to that rate. So basically, every physician in this country is going to take a 25-30% pay cut if nothing is done. I'm sure something will be done. I hope so. But yeah, that's a concern for my profession and, you know, the livelihood of my family.
This has been a great discussion. The discussion will continue. The work on healthcare reform legislation will continue. But just to wrap up our discussion today, I'm going to go back to Jenny. There are lots of people out there listening to us, Jenny. What can they do to enter into this very important process themselves as citizens?
I think that's the most important piece that we need to touch on, and there's a lot that can be done. We need to remain vigilant, as we've discussed throughout this entire show. And in doing that, that means that we need to be contacting our elected officials on this issue. We need to bring up the concerns. We don't need to feel intimidated if we don't know every amendment or every, you know, number that legislation is referred to. We need to send a message that, yes, healthcare reform is needed, but we need to keep in mind certain principles, certain Catholic principles that are important to us. And we need to, on a consistent basis, be contacting our elected representatives, either via phone, via email, via letters. We need to keep the pressure on them and let them know that we are paying attention and we're watching what they do.
Thank you. We'll conclude our time together today by turning in prayer to our Heavenly Father. Lord God, as we know we are in your holy presence, we call upon the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, that you will send to us your Holy Spirit. Send your Holy Spirit especially to guide those who are charged with leading our country as legislators, as members of the executive branch, and yes, of the judiciary. We look to them for wise and prudent and good leadership. Help them to understand the needs of people in this process of healthcare reform, to always pay attention to the sanctity, to the dignity of every human person. We ask our Blessed Mother to intercede also for all of us, and may God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
And thanks to both of you for being here today. Jenny Kraska of the Colorado Catholic Conference and Dr. Peter Zimmer from St. Francis Medical Center. I'm Bishop Michael Sheridan thanking all of you for listening in today and just underscoring what Jenny just said. Be part of this process. It's so very, very important for us and for those who will come after us. God bless all of you, and we'll be back to talk another day.
Thank you, Bishop.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Join us each week as Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs discusses topics relevant to your life and your faith. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Catholic Radio Network and the Diocese of Colorado Springs. If there is a topic that you'd like to hear covered by Bishop Sheridan Presents, please call the Catholic Radio Network at 970-669-8000.